We've all had to get used to walking in parking lots and suddenly becoming aware that there's a car behind us trying to get past. We didn't hear it because it's a hybrid or straight electric, so no engine noise, just the sound of tires on pavement. Hybrids and electrics make up a greater proportion of the driving fleet now. They're not the novelty they once were, and they certainly get plenty of study at the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center at the Institute of Transportation Studies at the University of California, Davis. Part of the recent research there is the finding that people are not just thinking about tailpipe emissions and saving the planet when they buy EVs and hybrids. Tom Turrentine is the director of the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center, and he's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Tom, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much for having me. It's great to get a chance to talk about this to your listeners.
It seems like there were a few dull days in that research center, primarily because things seem to change very fast with plug-in hybrids and electric vehicles.
Oh, yeah, the technology is really it's exciting. I've been doing this for almost 30 years now, and paying attention to the changes. Exciting to get to this point and actually have the vehicles out in the market and in a whole variety of vehicles. And it's moving quickly. The batteries have always been the problem and still are in really advancing these vehicles. But there's been tremendous progress, and it's exciting to see all the car makers make some interesting cars now.
You mentioned you've been involved in technology for 30 years. Now, how long has the center itself existed?
The center is about 8 years old, formed by the state of California. It actually got very interested in the plug-in hybrid possibilities about 12 years ago. The legislature and asked the Energy Commission to form a center that would look more carefully at these vehicles. And then because battery progress, all battery electrics became interesting also to the state. And we've been looking at. We're the research branch for the state of California on this, and we have been helping them understand how the technology and how the markets are developing.
So within the at least somewhat electric vehicle market, where are we going with regular hybrids, plug-in hybrids, straight electrics? I mean, what portion of the market do each of those three represent at this point?
Well, for the United States, these are very small portions of the overall market in the United States, which has been a booming market the last few years since the recession, bounding right back to where it was at the heyday in the 90s. All automakers are selling about 17 million vehicles per year. And right now, electric vehicles are less than a percent of that. Hybrids are about 2%. And have actually dropped off a little bit with the low prices of gasoline and diesel. There's been some loss of sales there and move to larger vehicles. Actually, that's one of the things going on. One of the bigger trends actually is drivers moving from smaller or compacts and mid-sized vehicles into SUVs and crossover vehicles. A huge trend in the auto market. In California and actually Oregon and Washington, there's been better sales of electrics. There's a lot of efforts locally, regulations also in California that have get those sales up around 3%.
All right, so still low there. But when you talk about people leaving smaller cars behind and moving onto the bigger ones, we're talking fuel-powered vehicles, though, with tailpipe.
Yeah, regular gasoline-powered. Yeah. Although this trend on a global basis, if we went outside the United States, actually sales of battery electric and plug-in hybrid vehicles has boomed in some other places, in particular China and Europe and Scandinavian countries have had very... have had rapid growth. The real outstanding case is Norway, with a broad set of incentives and a commitment from the government, actually has sales up to 35% of the market now on an annual basis.
Wow, that's impressive, 35%. Tom Turrentine's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the director of the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center at the Institute of Transportation Studies at the University of California, Davis. Your questions, comments about electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Maybe you've got one of these vehicles and have some stories to share with us or have been wondering about them before you go ahead and commit. Maybe you're not an early adopter. We'd like to hear that story, too. Again, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Give us a sense of the advantages of a plug-in hybrid over just a regular hybrid.
Well, a plug-in hybrid allows you to use the electricity from a, you know, a plug. That's where it gets the name, of course. And so you're plugging into the grid, and then depending on the size of the battery in your vehicle, there's tremendous variety of these vehicles. So everything from we measure battery size in kilowatt hours, and a regular hybrid like a Prius has a very small battery up and starting with plugging in 3 kilowatts and 7 and 10 kilowatts. These are batteries that one of them is probably the size of a large lunch pail, and then moving up to something that's, you know, 3 or 4 lunch pail size, and then up to a Tesla, which is an all battery with a battery that's underneath the entire pan of the car and is 85 kilowatt hours. So these are a huge variety in the size of that battery, and then depending on what kind of plug. You know, you can set a lot of these cars with smaller batteries, just need to plug into a regular wall plug at your house up to the Tesla is best with some very fast, powerful plugs, sort of industrial capacity plugs that can deliver electricity fast enough to charge that battery.
The fast chargers that are out there along the so-called electric highway on the West Coast, uh-huh. I mean, is that what the Tesla takes? It doesn't take something above that, does it?
Yes, it does.
Really?
Actually, oh yeah, the Tesla actually has its own proprietary. It can, you can adapt it to those. Tesla drivers have an adapter, but Tesla has its own proprietary charge network in the United States. Developed its own, and across the United States is actually the most complete system. And those are many of those are at a power level of what you call 100 kilowatts. So in an hour, they can deliver 100 kilowatts in an hour. So you can imagine in a half hour, 45 minutes, you can get pretty much recharge, replenish your car unless you've drained it all the way down. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, people have used about half the battery. And so then about 35, 40 minutes, they can recharge that on their Tesla on one of those chargers, which okay. are very powerful.
Wow. So how few and far between are the proprietary Tesla charging units?
Well, you can actually go to their site. Probably the best thing is just go to their site and look at the network. If you look across the United States, they have several hundred, you know, locations. Many of those locations have anywhere from 2 to 8 chargers at them, so that you can see a row of them. One of the ones. So if you think about a stretch of road, like between Portland and San Francisco, there might be, you know, 4 or 5 locations along that that are available for Tesla drivers. They're putting similar numbers for the electric road for other cars like the Nissan Leaf, but that vehicle only getting about 100 miles obviously needs a lot more chargers than a Tesla, which gets 240 to 300 miles of range.
Okay, I'm really when I looked at the stuff that you're doing at the plug-in hybrid and electric vehicle research center, I focused up on Scott Hardman's research into the motives of EV buyers. Were there some uh-huh. surprises in what you guys dug up there?
Well, we do a lot of work in that. I'm not an engineer. I'm an anthropologist. Had lots of engineers working for our center that I've been directing for 20 years. So we have a mix, sort of a multidisciplinary group. So we do a lot of work, you know, interviewing and talking to and surveying buyers as well as people who don't buy. And we've learned a lot about buyers over time. Scott's work, Scott was visiting here from England, and his work, he was very interested in Tesla's buyers and what they're doing. Some of the interesting things was that the Tesla buyers, for example, just were very interested in the technology. As a group of buyers, we kind of know that about them, that they're not so much interested. The green is part of their decision, but people have sort of a web of reasons they do things, but they're just technology, very technology-oriented group of buyers with very high incomes.
So. You know, we talked to a race car driver who'd spent a couple of years on Top Gear a couple mm-hmm. of days ago. He raved about the Model S, as did yeah. Some of the reviewers. What is it about the Teslas in particular that make people drool?
Well, we knew a little bit about this. you know, you can emphasize with any car, whether it's gasoline or electric, the efficiency or power of the vehicle. And electric vehicles aren't really different. You can put a large electric motors, and electric motors, that's what drives trains around. They have tremendous power. You have a diesel engine to charge the batteries on a train, but to move a train, you use an electric motor. That's what moves a train.
Yeah, electric motors on the axles, traction motors.
Yeah, it has more torque. So that's one of the characteristics of electric motors is maximum torque at zero rotations, which means if you want to accelerate from zero to something, your electric motor is the best way to do that. So we already knew that about AC motors. Then it's just how big of an AC motor you want to try to, you know, couple to your car. And some people, even predecessors to Tesla, were putting 200 horsepower electric motors on, and given them the torque in those, you could, if you wanted to, you could just spin the wheels till the rubber burned off of them. So we knew this could happen for power, and then it's a matter of did you want to emphasize power or efficiency in a vehicle. Tesla obviously took this to heart as a marketing strategy that consumers wanted, you know, a fast, performance-oriented vehicle, especially in a large sedan, and we're able to outperform. It's a large five-passenger sedan with two trunks, and yet it outperforms, you know, two-seater exotic sports cars with gasoline engines. So that was very exciting for buyers.
You know, as we've been talking about, you really opened my eyes about the Tesla charging network, and I've been looking at what's available in our region and noticing in a couple cases in Ashland and in Sutherland, for example, Oregon, they are attached to hotels, and they're for patrons only. There is one at Crater Lake National Park that's open to the public, but it's interesting to see the kind of club that's building up around Tesla vehicles and the chargers.
Sure. Yeah, there is a club part of it, and actually some of these chargers, some of these people are very enthusiastic about their car that we talk to, and going to, one I like to think of is they're along I-5 between Sacramento and Los Angeles, Interstate 5, there's a set of Tesla chargers at a steakhouse along that road. I forgot what the name of that steakhouse is, but there's eight chargers, maybe even more. And Tesla drivers who, from their income category, we would have guessed they'd fly between San Francisco and L.A., now are driving their car, and they love to pull up at this steakhouse and visit with each other while they charge their car. So there is a club and social aspect to it.
Tom Turrentine's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He directs the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center at the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis. You're welcome to join the conversation with some questions for Tom, which he appears to have many answers for. Maybe some stories to relate as well about electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids. We'd like to hear those. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's start with David in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yeah, hi, thanks for taking my call. We have a Nissan Leaf, and when we bought it, it was marketed to get 100 miles per charge, and it does when the weather's good. But when it's less than 40 degrees or even 45 degrees, it only shows 60 to 65 miles. And if you're commuting to Medford from Ashland, 100 miles gets you there and back with room to drive and do errands. 65 miles does not. It gets you really, really nerve-wrackingly running out of energy, especially if you have to actually turn on the defrost. I find that if I turn the defrost on, I have to, like, watch the miles click by. They just disappear, like, minute by minute, my 65 miles just disappear. So I frequently am wearing a hat and a scarf in my brand-new car, driving along as if it's some sort of clunker, or I have to stick my head out the window because I can't run the defrost. So my question is, has he seen similar performance problems with most of these plug-in hybrids in that when it gets cold, they lose up to 40% of their mileage? And does he know which brands or models are doing better with cold weather situations? Because they obviously did not test it in our situation.
Okay, great set of questions. Thanks for those, David. Tom?
Yeah, so cold weather, you know, was a challenge for electric vehicles. Most gasoline vehicles have tremendous amount of, you know, that efficiency question. If you get a whole bunch of gasoline, that's lots of energy stored on board, but you're not very efficient. Most gasoline engines are anywhere from, you know, 17% to 30% efficient, and so they have all this waste heat which you can use to heat the car. With electric vehicles, you don't have all this stored energy on board. You have a limited amount of energy in the batteries, and so using energy for heating becomes a problem. You'd get categorized, David, as an innovator in our studies, right? As somebody willing to take risks and learn about things. This batteries were small, smaller than than some of us thought should go out on the market in the first few years, but there was a lot of competition to get going with these vehicles. I think we're going to see, we already see with the Nissan Leaf, an improvement in the size of the battery. The systems for heating are more efficient. They're moving towards things called heat pump systems rather than traditional air conditioning systems. So there are rapid improvements. I was just in Scandinavia a few weeks ago, and so Swedes and Norwegians and these folks have also been dealing with this cold weather, and some of them are you know, they're kind of used to the cold, and they say, oh, it's not a big problem, but you know that they're not using it on the coldest days of the year. So cold is a big issue. The solution really is bigger batteries, which are coming down the road in the next iterations of these vehicles. Already, Nissan Leaf, about a 30% improvement. We'll see doubling of the size of these batteries by 2018 in many of these vehicles. So you happen to be a pioneer buying the first generation and learning both the limitations and being maybe a little down the curve in terms of what was actually available from the manufacturers.
Tom, does there appear to be a magic number, mileage number? I mean, like if a car could get consistently 300 miles on a charge with some appliances running, that would convince a lot of people to make the switch?
This is an interesting question. It was really the origins of my research in the 1990s to look at what was a magic number. The car makers had told me with gasoline vehicles, they had... And when they dropped on a few cars back in the 70s, under 200 miles of gasoline, they found problems. And so 200 was seen as a minimum threshold and a preferable about 300 miles of range. Electric vehicles, that's quite a challenge. You can imagine even the Tesla has, 300. So they put it right there, Tesla. But that was a luxury vehicle. It's a very expensive battery. So cost is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's exactly a magic number. It might be different, a little bit different for electrics because you do charge them at home. And so every time you come back to the house, you can charge the vehicle depending on how people use them. We looked at how people use their vehicles, how much they drive, and it's not what their average daily driving, and then the person just on the phone can answer that. It's where you got to go, you know, at least once a month or once a week. That's at the limits, you know, and then you need to charge out there. So it really varies a lot per household. I think that probably between 150 and 200 miles will capture most of the market for all battery electrics. And of course, plug-in hybrids like the Volt don't have those sorts of limits.
Okay, another call here. This is Tony in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tom Turrentine.
Good morning. Yes, I as an engineer by training, I would love a toy like this, but it is really a toy. In terms of the power has to come from somewhere, and it comes from electricity. At the moment, that is 57% coal generated electricity in this country, and perhaps they can do a little better in Scandinavia with hydroelectric electricity. But the point is that it's a long way from becoming something that is environmentally sound. It's a plaything for the rich and for which the poor subsidize them to the tune of $7,500 for every car. But isn't it a realistic solution for the long term? If you live in LA, it makes sense. Mexico City, maybe, because the pollution is transferred from your horribly polluted city to somewhere where the generation of electricity goes on. But until generation of electricity is advanced faster than the rate at which we're working on electric cars, it isn't really environmentally sound.
All right, let's get a response. Thanks for that, Tony. Appreciate it.
So this is a great question, and it's a reality. There's a lot of coal production in the world, although coal production, if you read about it, coal miners are going out of business now. Demand for coal is dropping. natural gas is replacing coal in the United States, and actually the amount of coal now in the United States is about 40% of national production. So natural gas has replaced, just in the last decade, a significant portion because it's cheaper than coal and will not incur the fines that some of the coal plants, which many of them are very old, the coal-fired plants, and they have trouble upgrading them, so they're going to be retired, a lot of coal plants, over the next couple of decades. So we do see improvement in the United States. Of course, still some lake locations will be predominantly coal. Natural gas is about a good improvement, depending, as long as there's no we deal with leakage in the system of methane, and that has to be worked on also. Methane being particularly terrible for
as a greenhouse gas.
As a greenhouse gas, more not as long lived as carbon dioxide, but very pernicious in the short term. So in terms of the overall system, we're actually looking ahead right now in some places in the United States where the market is good, Washington, Oregon, California, parts of the Northeast, where the market is just getting started. Fortunately, the electricity mix is relatively clean. In the center of the country and across broad parts of the South, the market involves a lot more coal, although that is turning around, and we haven't had it. Like I said, the coal is going to be phased out over a period of time here. So it is promising, and especially an important year will be 2025, when the price of batteries makes cars of an equivalent price, so it isn't just a rich person's toy, and batteries are improving at about a 12% improvement per year right now in costs and all parameters. So we're thinking 2025 is a great year for the success of this technology.
Okay, we know you'll be out there in front looking at it. Tom Turrentine is the director of the Plug-in Hybrid and Electric Vehicle Research Center at the Institute of Transportation Studies at UC Davis. Thanks so much for joining us today, Tom.
Sure, great.
Take care.